Hello, I'm Jen Jones. This is number 0623, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0623. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet Sasha Voss, who is the author of a very innovative pictorial history tome called 400 Years of New York History. It's a book with stunning visuals.
It's actually inherited from the matte painting, the technique that was used in the cinematography that would replace would be a very photorealistic paintings of the landscape. Now it becomes art form of its own. So it's a combination of 3D modeling, Photoshop work, brush work with addition of photography and some other elements. So it's a production. It involves all different creative elements.
Alex Sanga is the producer of the documentary Emergence, Out of the Shadows, which looks at the journey of LGBT South Asians dealing with their conservative parents.
Even though in Sikhism there's not really anything mentioned in the Sikh holy book about Sikh Guru Granth Sahib about homosexuality, the culture has not really changed. And people expect you to get married and have children. You know, my father told me, I love you as a son, but I don't approve of your lifestyle. He thinks it's a lifestyle. He thinks it's a sin. He thinks I'm choosing this world and life that I am as a gay person. And it's like, you know, sometimes you're talking to a wall. Like, he doesn't understand that this is how God has created me. I have no choice over this.
Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com is back, reaching new heights with the world's tallest man.
He was born in 1918, February 22nd, in Alton, Illinois, and he was normal at that point. He was 9 pounds, but then his pituitary gland took over and became very overactive, and that's what caused all of his massive growth. I mean, by the time he was about 6 months old, he weighed 62 pounds already. When he was 9, he was carrying around his dad, who weighed 150 pounds. By 13, he was 7 feet, 4 inches.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day coming your way. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0623, was Jen Jones, who is a Montreal-based fine arts artist. Thank you very much, Jen, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, this story is just really out there. An arrest warrant was issued July 8th in Little Rock, Arkansas for 32-year-old Brian Dale Reams in connection with several incidents where he allegedly approached women and asked if he could touch their feet. But this story has a curious twist. In Conway, Arkansas, a woman said a man with no arms followed her into a Walmart store in September, telling her that she had pretty feet and asked if she liked having people touch them. Now, later, he began harassing her on Facebook. How he got to know her Facebook account, I don't know, but I digress. In June, a second woman said a man matching the same description, but wearing a face mask with Brian written on it, followed her around the same Walmart and wondered if she'd let him give her a foot massage. Again, he has no arms. He apparently didn't explain how that might work. A third woman identified Reams after viewing screenshots of his Facebook account. He approached her in a Kroger store. You just know that in court, his lawyer is going to say, "Where is the evidence of a threat?" This could be interesting because he has no arms, and his case might actually have a leg to stand on. Anyway, California Highway Patrol officers were called to a spot on I-80 near the Nevada border on July 15th because of a car on fire. When they got there, they discovered a man yelling about the bears.
The bears!
The bears!
No, not those bears. After talking with him, they determined that the man had set his own car on fire to ward off bears. Said Officer Carlos Perez, "Listen, we have bears in the area, but there are no bears nearby. You can't light a fire on the hood of your vehicle to keep the bears away." He was placed under arrest for being under the influence of drugs and or alcohol and arson. Maybe he watched too many cartoons as a kid.
I have had it, boo-boo. I'm gonna bust out of here.
How come, Yogi?
Every day it's the same old thing. Look at the bears, look at the bears, look at the bears. Sheesh.
Yeah, that's probably it. 53-year-old Robert Perez was pulled over in Iowa City, Iowa on July 15th for erratically driving a stolen Kawasaki motorcycle. He told police that he had borrowed the bike from a fellow meth user, but he couldn't provide the name or address of that friend. Perez admitted that he had injected meth 5 hours earlier. While in police custody, he was caught Googling how long meth stays in your system after initial consumption. And let's pause right there for a second. How is someone caught Googling in police custody? In that situation, why are they near anything that can Google? Anyway, investigators obtained a blood sample from Perez and sent it to the crime lab. He was booked for theft, DUI, and driving with a suspended license. Of course, he had a suspended license. They always do in these stories. And finally, an unnamed 31-year-old woman in Beechwood, Ohio, went on a spectacular joyride on June 15th, crashing into another car at more than 100 miles per hour before spinning into a utility pole, another car, and a house. Surprisingly, no one was hurt in the series of crashes, including the driver and her 11-year-old daughter, who was sitting in the front seat with her. Officers didn't detect any evidence of drug or alcohol use. Instead, the driver told police that she had been going through some, quote, trials and tribulations, unquote, and was recently fired from her job, so she let go and let God take the wheel.
Jesus, take the wheel. Take it from my hands, 'cause I can't do this on my own. I'm letting go.
Well, therein lies her problem. She let God take the wheel. I believe his son is a better driver. Anyway, she went on to say that she believes she had done the right thing. She now faces charges of felony assault, endangering a child, and yes, the prerequisite driving under suspension. Will they ever learn? At least she wasn't drinking, because if she had been, I wouldn't have played Carrie Underwood. Instead, I would have played this.
I'm gonna do some drinking, so you should probably steer. I'm counting on you, Jesus, take the wheel.
There's a lot of drinking and Jesus in country music, but I digress. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Ever wonder what lays beneath the high-rise buildings of New York, or the city's role in finalizing and celebrating the Constitution? Did you know that New York was the first U.S. capital? Sasha Voss created a book that shares fascinating facts about New York and the role the city has played in the country from colonial times until today for its culture and financial influence and its popularity as a tourist destination. The book is called 400 Years of New York History, a pictorial guide, Book 1, New York as New Amsterdam in the 1600s. Sasha joins us via Skype from the Big Apple. Hi, Sasha.
Hello, Peter. Good to be on your show.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So as I mentioned with that title, I'm assuming that there's more to this in the future than the book that is already out.
Oh, absolutely. There will be Book 2 that will cover 1700s and 1800s, and Book 3 will bring us all the way to 220.
Now, what caught my eye, which is why I wanted to call you, is first of all, I've seen pictures from the book, which are absolutely breathtaking. You do something called photorealism, a technique that combines photography, 3D modeling, and painting, correct?
That's correct.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's actually inherited from the matte painting, the technique that was used in the cinematography that would replace what would be a very photorealistic paintings of the landscapes of the and now it becomes art form of its own. So it's a combination of 3D modeling, Photoshop work, and and brush work, as long actually with addition of photography and some other elements. So it's a production. It involves all different elements of creative elements.
And the end result, which I can't do it justice describing it on the radio, but the end result is you get a vivid picture of what New York looked like back in the 1600s to see, for instance, the island of Manhattan with complete vegetation and no high-rise buildings on it is rather kind of shocking and breathtaking, but it also gives you an idea of what the appeal of the area was for the people who settled there.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. Some people are even mistaking some of the bird-eye views. They're saying, oh, where did you get that photograph? Well, it was hard to get a photograph in the 1600s. So that was the whole idea. What I wanted to really bring up the latest in the historical discoveries, and apparently things are still coming up. And some things are crossing out, some older versions of what the city was like. I wanted to really make it as historically correct as possible. And I also wanted to give that very today kind of feeling of high definition imagery that everybody could relate to, especially kids that would have no way to kind of to relate to the centuries gone by.
How did this project come to be in the first place?
I was a producer of the live entertainment, actually the Moscow Circus producer, and I wanted to do something about New York's history, all these almost 40 years that I've been living in New York, and I decided to do something that was kind of live entertainment. I started doing research, and to my absolute amazement, I found out that there was basically nothing visually that we have inherited for about 200 first years of New York's existence. And then I realized that nobody really took an effort of recreating, reconstructing the history. And I decided, well, forget my producer's kind of idea. Let me dig into that, because my past is, I'm an architect by training, and I was photorealistic illustrator in New York for about 5-6 years. So I thought, that's something that I need to do. So I left everything just for this project.
What was the biggest hurdle in putting the book together?
Basically, as I said, I had to start from scratch, and I had to approach it from the point of view that is not historical, but being an architect, kind of architectural detective. And I had to go and put the pieces together of what like the first village of New Amsterdam could have looked like, because it's no brainer. We know how the dugouts looked at the time, how the Dutch built their forts. And so I just, lack of visual inheritance or a lack of visual representation of the city at the time, that was the main problem. And apparently it was solvable. You know, I could find the ways of bringing up on the page.
Now, as you mentioned, this is the first of several books that you're planning on doing. Again, looking at what I've been able to see so far online, it is quite breathtaking, but it leads me to thinking about other iconic locations in North America that have a rich history. Places like Boston, places like where I am right here in Montreal. Can you envision a time when what you're doing with New York will be done with other places? One of the oldest settlements is in Florida. Other places like that, getting this treatment that you're now doing with New York?
Yes, Peter, absolutely. I definitely, I just need to really get this project finalized and finished. And there are a number of spin-offs that are going to take place. So when I'm done with my town, I'd be happy to, or if I'll be lucky enough to attract investment, basically, to get help, I would be absolutely, I'm definitely up to that task.
What are some of the spin-offs that you just described?
Well, the book is just the beginning. Obviously, I want to move into different formats of the book. There will be video, audio, like multi formats with different ways of presenting the book. I want to do interactive website where people will be able, just like you were looking at the, say, village of New Amsterdam, you could click on all different elements of it and get expanded information, both visual and in captions. So there are, as you can see, there is definitely an artistic element, and I've been asked a number of times to produce just wall art with these pieces. So I want this to get into as many hands and in different formats as possible, so that people could be really enriched with what a fantastic history New York had, visual history. So those are some of the spin-offs.
You mentioned video ideas that you're thinking of working on for this project. With the use of photorealism techniques, could you envision a situation, for instance, where you might have a time-lapse photography kind of thing, where one would actually visualize what, say, Manhattan looked like in the 1600s and moving forward through a period of time in a visual way?
Excellent idea. Yes, I would. It would be great to get to that when I'll have my two other books done. So when I'll have all the, because now they all sketched, they all prepared, everything's done, just basically waiting for the money to come in. But when I'll have the finished products, absolutely, then it will be quite easy to do.
Couple of things. When is the first book now available? Number one. And number two, when will the others, the follow-ups as you're talking about, when will they be ready?
Yeah, this book is definitely available on every ebook store. It's the printed book is available for the stores, at the local wholesaler Bookazine, but otherwise from my website. And I hope to start getting to the next one probably next year, because I really now at the point where I'm doing marketing of the first book, and that's taking all of my attention. It's impossible. It's a different animal of its own. So that's what I'm planning on getting. I'm getting to the second book.
I'm talking to you from Montreal, and some people might be saying, why is a book about New York so important? And I can answer that right off the bat, and that is New York, of course, is one of the most iconic cities, not only in North America, but in the world. So its history is very interesting. But again, it's the combination of how you've put this book together that is so visually appealing that you really can't take your eye off of it. And one gets a sense when they look at this work that you've done, not only what can be done for New York, but what can be done, like I said, for other cities. You really get a sense in looking at the history of what the future can be when it comes to books like these.
You're so right, because it's very poorly. History of every major town is really underrepresented. It needs to be celebrated with materials like my book, with live entertainment. I've been traveling a lot, and you absolutely touching on a very right moment. Yes, I hope this book will start other people in other cities thinking of that they really should look into their past with more attention and use the local the tools that are available right now.
I can imagine what an educational tool this will be in schools.
Yes. You should see social studies teachers, because I've been doing the presentations while I was working all these 5 years in the local schools. It's unbelievable the way the teachers looking at the screen. To them, it's God-given kind of thing, because there is nothing at their disposal really to describe it to the kids. So it definitely is a big time. That's my two main markets, education and tourism, because also those people get to see nothing of old New York at all.
It's the wave of the future.
That's it. Thank you.
People can get a sense of what I'm talking about by going to your website, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
And that's VostTimeTravelGuide.com?
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm.
Sasha, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. And again, congratulations on an amazing project.
Thank you so much, sir. I really appreciate it.
Sasha Vosk, who created the amazing book, 400 Years of New York History, A Pictorial Guide, Book 1, New York as New Amsterdam in the 1600s. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0623, and you'll find links to Sasha's website, where you can get glimpses of the book and, of course, order it, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can also order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Alex Sanga, the producer of Emergence Out of the Shadows. Plus, Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com is back with another weird historical fact for the program. This one, of course, for the month of July. And we also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere for all your devices on everything from Spotify to iHeartRadio to Apple and Google Podcasts, just to name a few of the streaming services. It's everywhere. And now portions of the program can be heard on the new audio service called Audia. That's A-U-D-E-A, a platform that allows you to listen to segments of audio much in the same way that YouTube allows you to watch videos. There you'll get to hear some fresh conversations from the Stuff File program, but you'll also get a chance to go back into our archives and hear chats going all the way back to 2009. Right now, there's over 500 items up on Audia from the Stuff File program, so check it out. That's the new service, Audia. That's A-U-D-E-A, audia.io. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? On July 18th, at an LDS church in St. George, Utah, 40-year-old Jeremy David Miller stripped off his underwear in the parking lot and, while nude, removed items from the trunk of his car and scattered them on the church lawn. Next, Miller went inside and slammed a child's car seat onto a table, knocking the sacrament tray and water to the ground. He then sped off in his Jeep. Officers found him at his home, where he came outside shouting and cursing at them. Miller continued to resist officers until handcuffs were applied. He faces multiple charges, including lewdness and assault against a police officer. By the way, the name of the jail they took him to was Purgatory Correctional Facility. Yeah. Only in Utah. And if you're keeping score, boys and girls, so far we have been driving and stripping in the name of the Lord. A Reno, Nevada woman was charged on July 14th in a break-in incident at a dental practice where she worked. Laurel Ike allegedly broke into the practice in May and stole $23,000 worth of checks and cash. In the course of the investigation, Ike also admitted to extracting 13 teeth from a sedated patient after using anesthetic discarded by the practice, even though she is not licensed to perform such procedures. Ike was charged with multiple felonies, including performing surgery on another without a license. So, she's going to jail for being down in the mouth. I'm guessing she worked for that fifth dentist. You know, the one who never agreed with the other four. According to police, 74-year-old Canadian Weigel Rosen, who has moved to Deerfield Beach, Florida, got into a heated verbal dispute with a ticket agent at the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport. Rosen started to walk away from the counter, but left his carry-on bag behind. The employee told Rosen that he needed to take his luggage with him, and he responded by telling the employee that there was a bomb in the bag. Because of the bomb threat, three of the airport's four terminals were evacuated, and the entire airport was shut down for several hours. The Broward Sheriff's Office bomb squad found no explosive devices, and Rosen was arrested, charged with making a false bomb threat, a second-degree felony. 8 flights were canceled, and more than 50 others were delayed. Okay, if we're going just by stereotypes, our Canadian friend, who lives in Florida, seems to be a dichotomy of personalities. I mean, as Canadians, we're supposed to be friendly and very polite, unless we're in a hockey fight. But as a Florida man, one might say all bets are off. So the question has to be asked, was Rosen a moron before he left Canada? Or is there something in the water in Florida that could potentially turn someone into a moron? And again, I'm not disparaging the fine, fine folks of Florida, but I will put in for a Canada grant for further scientific research into this matter, because that's another stereotype. In Canada, we love applying for grants. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a camper at the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in northeastern Minnesota reported to the U.S. Forest Service that a bear stole his backpack, apparently attracted by several delicious-smelling snacks inside. Normally, rangers wouldn't bother to respond to such cases, but there was something else in the backpack, a pistol. A state conservation officer joined the USFS to search for the armed Bruin and found the shredded backpack and empty snack wrappers nearby. It definitely smelled of food, said Officer Mary Manning of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. The bear, however, wasn't interested in the gun. The pistol was still enclosed in its case inside the backpack. Now, I know you Americans have the right to bear arms, but do you have the right to arm bears? I'm just asking. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Back in 2013, we talked to Alex Sanga, who is the author of Catalyst, a collection of commentaries to get us talking. It was a book designed to encourage conversation about subjects that are sometimes hard to talk about. Well, Alex is back because he has since taken that idea a little further. He is releasing his documentary film this month called Emergence, Out of the Shadows. It focuses on the parents of gays and lesbians within traditionally conservative South Asian families. Alex joins us on the line once again from Vancouver. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again. It's a very difficult topic to deal with for a lot of people, I'm sure. What made you decide to make this film?
Well, you know, Peter, it was so difficult and challenging for me to come out as a gay South Asian male when I was going through high school and you know, back when I was in high school in the 1990s, there was no internet, there was no cell phones, there was no gay straight alliances, there was nothing like Grindr. There was nothing for me to get support. I was all alone, I was alienated, I was isolated. I literally actually thought there was something wrong with me because I had thoughts of, you know, men, and I actually didn't understand why I wasn't attracted to women. And there was no education. My family, my mom didn't understand. I was raised by a single mother. I secretly went to see a psychiatrist and a doctor. I was so afraid and so scared and so worried. And I had what they called internalized homophobia, which means you do not like yourself for being gay. You want to be straight. So it took me a lot of self-reflection and to get to a point of self-love. It took me a lot of education and understanding and awareness to feel good about who I am. And I wanted other people in the community, other young people in the community, not only in the South Asian community, but in the broader community, to not have to suffer like I suffered in silence and by myself. I wanted them to have support. I wanted them to have education. I want them to have awareness. And what is the great thing about Emergence Out of the Shadows, Peter, is not only does it give hope to the gay and lesbian kids and the children who are coming out, it actually focuses on the parents as well and their journey and their struggle and their strength to accept their children.
Well, that's something I wanted to talk about because when I heard that you were making this movie, I thought of the extreme uphill battle you must have in getting this story across. And here's the point I'm making. Are you familiar with Leslie Udwin and her documentary film, India's Daughter?
You know, I've heard of that film, but I haven't actually watched it.
Okay. I actually had a chance to talk to Leslie, and I've seen the movie. For those who aren't familiar with the film, it deals with the brutal murder of a girl who was on the bus. She was gang raped and her assailants are in prison. But the thing that I found most harrowing about that story, as brutal as the crime itself was the fact that in that particular society, there was not a lot of remorse on the part of those who committed the crime. And also, even though there were major protests by women in the streets of India because of that crime took place, there was still a large portion of the population that didn't have a problem with it because their thought was, here was a girl who was not married, was out going to see a movie with a male that was not related to her, and therefore, in some ways, this whole thing was justified. The reason why I bring that up is, if that's a problem, how difficult is it to be within the East Asian community to be gay or trans?
Yeah, it's South Asian community, and yeah. It's very difficult, it's very challenging, it's very challenging. It's like it's a very conservative family, and being gay is a taboo. I mean, even though in Sikhism there's not really anything mentioned in the Sikh holy book about Sikh Guru Granth Sahib about homosexuality, the culture has not really changed, and people expect you to get married and have children, and, you know, my father told me, I love you as a son, but I don't approve of your lifestyle. He thinks it's a lifestyle, he thinks it's a sin, he thinks I'm choosing this world and life that I am as a gay person, and it's like, you know, sometimes you're talking to a wall, like, he doesn't understand that this is how God has created me. I have no choice over this. Why would I choose to live in suffering, and why would I choose to live in a world where people discriminate against me and oppress me and hate me? I told my parents, I said, why would God want his children to suffer? We are all God's children. Why would he create, you know, gay kids if he wanted them to suffer? We need to love each other. We need to respect each other. And we need to treat each other with dignity and with compassion.
Now, you're in the movie. Your mother's in the movie. It's about parents. So there are other parents of gay and lesbian members of the community within the movie. In putting this film together as an executive producer, did you find that the stories of the others in the film besides your own had a very similar ring to it as far as the relationship between the children and their parents?
You know what? You know, the common themes, the common emotions of struggle and love and acceptance and fear of rejection from the kids is all there. However, the three stories of myself, of Caden and Jag are very, very different. You have to watch the film to find out, but I'll give you a little bit of a sneak peek. Jag is, you know, a lesbian woman, a gay woman who is struggling to come out. All of a sudden, she finds out her brother is also gay. Both children in the family are gay. The parents are devastated, and then you go on to find out how Jag lives her life as a lesbian woman and what happens to her in terms of having a family and settling down and having children. So that's kind of Jag, but I mean, I'm not going to give away at the end what happens to Jag. And then what happened to Caden? Caden was a young man in his early 20s. He was studying as an international student from Ludhiana, Punjab, which is a city in India. And he was studying at Langara College in Vancouver. And his whole family in India found out, and Canada found out, that he was gay. He was staying with relatives in Surrey, and they all disowned him. His whole family disowned him. He was stuck in a foreign country with no food, no shelter, no money for tuition. He was in limbo with his immigration status. He contacted my nonprofit, and I thought, is this a joke? Could this be happening in this country? And, you know, when I saw him, he was shaking. He was skinny. He was very, very distressed and crying and didn't know what to do. His eyes were shaking. He didn't sleep for many, many days. And you find out what happens to Caden in this story and how he is really a survivor and resilient. And you find out really quite... his story is really quite amazing. And all three stories, actually, my story, Jag's story, and Caden's story, you have these three stories going along in the film, and you don't really know how they're going to connect at the end, but somehow we figured out a way to connect them all. So it's quite exciting to watch the film just to figure that out.
So who exactly did you make the movie for? And the reason why I asked that question is you said earlier that when you were growing up, there was no representation. There was no one to look towards or up to. So did you make it for the kids coming up behind you who may be living in fear, especially if they're of South Asian descent and want to come out? Or did you make the film for the straight community to learn about what is going on and to be more accepting?
To be honest, you know, the film is having an impact across a lot of different segments of the population. And, you know, what makes it very interesting, I actually made the film for gay and lesbian kids to give them hope. But, you know, the film, we brought the parents into the film, and now the parents are saying there is no other films which parents can get information and help from, and this is like the only resource. And a lot of times, parents of gay kids don't know anyone else, know any other parents of gay kids. So this resort, this film is really filling a void and providing support not only to the gay kids, but also to the parents. And also other people are just connecting with the story because it's a very emotional story, a very human story, very emotionally gripping and touching, heart-wrenching story. And anyone with any kind of conscious or feelings or emotions would connect to this human level story. And so it's connecting with a broader audience as well. And we have actually, our first film festival notification is July 23rd, but we have already had advanced notification from three festivals, but I'm not allowed to announce them. One of them is in Toronto and one of them is in the Vancouver area and one is in India, but I'm not allowed to announce who it is yet because the film festival likes to do their own announcements. But I'm very excited. We are, I'm getting a good response so far. And we had the whole community. This is really a community project, Peter. We had at least 30, 35 community sponsors backing this film. We had Creative BC and Telefilm Canada helped with marketing. And we had Van City, which is a major credit union in the Vancouver area. We had the BC Arts Council and the province of British Columbia, the city of Vancouver, the city of Surrey, city of Delta. So many, you know, government and nonprofits and social justice organizations came together for this film and helped fund it. So I'm really grateful to the community. I'm really grateful to the cast and the crew. I'm really grateful to everyone who helped us share our stories. It's not very often that you get to share stories about BIPOC people, people of color, of queer people, people with a lived experience that we have. You know, you really don't get to see ourselves on screen that very often. It's a very rare event for that to happen. And so now we will be seeing ourselves on screen. OutTV, which is a gay and lesbian public broadcaster in Canada, is going to broadcast the film across Canada. And I just signed a distribution deal with Moving Images Distribution in Vancouver, which is a social justice distributor. They will be selling the film with a teacher's discussion guide to high schools, colleges, universities across the country. So I'm very grateful. I feel so lucky, so blessed. And I feel sometimes when you go out into the universe and you have good intentions and you want to make a change and you want to, you know, help people, then people respond to that. And I just really feel that's what's happening with this film.
Well, we have less than a minute, so I got to ask this one question, because you say you're going to put it in a film festival in India. as what I said earlier about Leslie's film, do you have any anticipation or anxiety over the idea that it will be played in India? Do you know any idea what reception you kind of expect?
I have no idea what's going to happen in India. I'm praying for the best. I think India is coming around. There's a lot of gay activists in India. There's a lot of queer people who are, you know, pushing the issue forward. And I have fingers crossed. You know, we tried our best with this film, and I hope it will change lives everywhere, including in India.
The film is Emergence, Out of the Shadows. Alex, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Alex Sanga, the producer of the film Emergence, Out of the Shadows. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0623, and you'll find links to Alex's site, which will share all the details you need to know about the film. And remember, you can also hear Alex's previous appearance from 2013 on show number 0204. It's also on the Audia audio service under the title Alex Sanga Catalyst, which was the title of his book. Again, all of those links are on the What's On page for this week's show, including links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com about the world's tallest man. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a new police officer called in that she was being tailed by a drone, and it may follow her for the rest of her career. She was directed to meet a senior officer at her Glasgow, Scotland police station. There, she pointed to the white light in the sky that she said she was unable to lose, and the senior officer informed her that that was not a drone. It was Jupiter. This young lady will probably find herself with a nickname for the rest of her career, said Tom Wood, a retired senior law enforcement officer. The story will be told for years to come. The real test is how she handles it. Well, at least we know she has good eyesight. No clue about astronomy, but good eyesight. And finally, a man was driving through Rootstown at 94 miles an hour when the Ohio State Highway Patrol stopped him. Problem? He had a bag of pot and did not want to be caught with it. Solution? He decided to swallow it. New problem. He couldn't breathe. When Trooper Charles Hoskin discovered this, he performed the Heimlich maneuver, causing the unnamed driver to cough up the evidence. Hoskin gave the driver a ticket for speeding and not wearing a seatbelt, a summons for the weed, and a warning for the man's biggest mistake. Do you want to die over a minor misdemeanor? That's a good warning. You see, this story proves a point that we can all learn from in these tumultuous times that we live in. With good police work, you can breathe. Anyway, let's get to our last guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Hartzman is the curator of the website weirdhistorian.com. I'm sure that most of you out there, just like we here at the Stuff File program, are curious about the Mark Hartzman origin story. So, via Skype from New York, we're strapping Mark to the Stuff File couch to find out why he likes weird, with a story of the tallest man ever. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So, this is where it all began for you?
Yeah, the story of Robert Wadlow, one of my favorite human beings ever. The tallest man who's ever lived. He was 8 feet, 11 and a half inches tall. And I first learned about Robert when I was a kid. And I would get those editions of the Guinness Book of World Records that came out every year. This was back when they were small little paperback black and white books, not the big full color ones they have now. And Robert Wadlow was usually the first thing in the book. And they'd have like, you know, human bodies or something like that would be the first chapter of the Guinness book. And right up front of that section was Robert Wadlow. And every year they'd have a couple different pictures and they'd have some stats about his growth. And I mean, it's just extraordinary. The man was truly a giant. He was born a normal size, and he was born in 1918, February 22nd, in Alton, Illinois, and he was normal at that point. He was 9 pounds, but then his pituitary gland took over and became very overactive, and that's what caused all of his massive growth. I mean, by the time he was about 6 months old, he weighed 62 pounds already. I mean, can you imagine
Lord.
That?
Okay.
I mean, it's crazy. By age of five, and they have all these stats, you know, in the Guinness book, and I was just in awe. You know, I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing that the body can reach these kinds of extremes.
And you know, you got to be certain that perhaps...
By the age of five, he was over 5 feet tall.
Yeah. You've got to think that when he weighs that much at 6 months old, that his grandmother, his mother's mother-in-law, was probably chastising the mother saying, what are you feeding that child?
Yeah, right. He's too big.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, these crazy stats. You know, when he was 9, he was carrying around his dad who weighed 150 pounds, like he was nothing.
Okay. How big was he when he was 9?
I don't have that height handy, but by the time he was 13, just to... you know, keep you in perspective. By 13, he was 7 feet, 4 inches.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Tallest teenager in the world at that point. So he had, you know, his first big title there. Played some basketball. I don't think he made any big impression, though, on the court. But I mean, aside from his sight, from his height. Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing. So he reached his height of 8 feet, 11 and a half inches tall. And he could have kept growing. But by this point, he suffered a blister. So he, just to back up a second, he would go out on the road and he would make appearances in public. And like he might work for a shoe company and do appearances in exchange for a custom-made 37AA shoe, for example. Because obviously he needed custom-made clothing and shoes. So companies would use him for publicity. In 1940, in July of 1940, which is why we're talking about him now for July, he was appearing at a festival in Michigan, which was sponsored by a shoe company, and he got this sore under his leg brace. You know, he had to have these braces to help support him because, you know, he was massive. And the brace caused this infection to set in on the sore, and it began to linger. And the hospitals there couldn't really accommodate him. So by the time he actually got the help he needed, this blister had this infection, which caused a fever of 106 degrees. And by the time doctors could do anything, they gave a blood transfusion, but it was too late. And so he passed away on July 15th at the age of 22.
Wow.
And he was still growing.
So he could have made 9 feet.
I think so. Yeah. And I'm, you know,
he was only
a
half an inch away,
but I wanted him to get to 9 feet. You know, you want to see that record happen. And it's a shame that something as ridiculous and silly as a blister on his foot would take the giant down.
So a 9 foot guy is done in by his toe. Basically,
yes,
is what you're saying.
That's right.
Wow. 37AA was the size of a shoe.
Yeah.
How can I put this delicately? First of all, I went to your website and there are pictures and videos of this guy.
Yeah.
There's that Fox special that is on your site that you can see from YouTube, correct?
Yeah, I have some video on here. Yeah, exactly. So you can see him walking like amongst the crowd and, you know, just completely towering over everyone, obviously. But it's such a remarkable difference. It's like he's almost twice the height of people.
Okay, so the thing that actually made me laugh was when I looked at that video or that documentary or part of it anyway, you could hear his voice. He's being interviewed and he's talking about the size of his shoe. And the line he says is, when I kick somebody, they stay kicked. It's like, really? And they also interviewed they interviewed his brother, and they interviewed a friend of his. This goes back to the delicate question I was asking before. Again, keep in mind, 9 foot tall, 37AA shoe. He and his friend would double date. I don't know how daring that girl would be. I don't know. That just doesn't seem right.
Yeah, that could have been a challenge.
What was it like when he showed up at the girl's house and was met by the father?
Right. Opens the door and he sees his waist. You know?
Yes, the part that he really doesn't want to look at.
Right. Yeah. Now, what an extraordinary life in every way possible.
So again, this was the beginning of your trip down the rabbit hole of weird?
Yeah, I mean, this is what really got me fascinated at an early age about just human oddities and anomalies. And again, like I said, the fact that body could reach these extremes. And then, you know, as of course with the Guinness book, you turn a page and then you've got the shortest person alive and the tallest twins and the guy with the crazy fingernails there, you know, 10 feet in length or whatever, you know. So all that stuff just started to stick with me. And I just became fascinated by all these unusual people and the stories behind them. And all that led up to things I write today. I wrote a book called American Sideshow, which features Robert Wadlow, lots of articles and everything else, all the other tangents I've taken into the world of the weird. I love it.
And to your knowledge, there has been no one even relatively close to this situation either before or after?
Well, certainly, if there's anyone who was before, there's no photographic evidence. There's really no stories of anyone that reaches this kind of height, like unless you go back to like Goliath in the Bible, which is probably not that accurate. But the tallest man alive now, who actually had the thrill of meeting years about 10 years ago, I think, his name is Sultan Kosin from Turkey. And when I met him, he was 8'1". I think he's 8'3" now, and he had the same pituitary gland issue, and I think doctors removed it or stopped it from, you know, becoming overactive or continuing to be overactive.
And how old was he?
He stopped growing.
How old was he, or is he? Do you
when
know?
I met him, he was in his, I think, I want to say he was in his early to mid 20s. And like I said, that was about 10 years ago. So we'll say like maybe mid 30s or so at this point.
So definitely a lot older than Robert ever got a chance to be.
Yes. And he walked, I mean, I mentioned that Robert had the braces. And when you see him in the video on weirdhistorian.com, I mean, he looks pretty normal with his movements. You know, he's huge, but he's walking fairly normally. Sultan Kosin, he had to have, I guess you'd say, you know, walkers for his arms, you know, to kind of put his arms in and then sort of help him balance himself just because he's so massive. And I think the weight makes it difficult to move easily. So he was having trouble at that point, just moving around, you know, in a smooth fashion. So I think he's definitely one of the people who's truly over 8 feet tall. There have been, I think, a few other people recorded over 8 feet tall. A lot of times, you know, in sideshow, people are advertised as being well over 8 feet tall, but typically they're not. It's an exaggeration. They might be more in the 7'6", 7 foot, you know,
yeah,
so, 7'5", a little bit taller, and they'll wear like tall hats to sort of exaggerate their height, and you know, different things you do to make them appear even taller.
Lifts.
yeah, totally.
Again, I watched the video on your website, and people should go to your website. Which is weirdhistorian.com. People should check this out. One of the things in the video is they show the 12 pallbearers to his funeral lugging that man's casket, which is about the size of a 1960s Buick station wagon.
I mean, about right.
It's huge.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, huge person. You gotta have a little extra space.
I mean, we are chuckling over this man's unfortunate story, but wow, that's something.
Now he's called the gentleman giant. Yeah. You know, I think he was a nice guy and just wanted to live a as normal a life as possible.
Yeah.
Under his circumstances.
Well, we've now learned the deep inner psyche of Mark Hartzman thanks to this story. Mark, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Peter. Appreciate it.
Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars. His website is weirdhistorian.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0623, and you'll find links to Mark's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's that time you've all been waiting for, boys and girls. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
A Missouri man was hospitalized after accidentally shooting himself while fishing. Let that image sink in for a moment. It happened at around 3 p.m. on a farm east of Lancaster, Missouri. The victim is 33-year-old Derek Shaw of Memphis, Missouri. And is victim really the right word here? Shaw was fishing alone on a family member's farm when the shooting happened. He told investigators he was messing around with his .357 Magnum when it accidentally discharged. The bullet from the handgun struck Shaw in the upper left chest area. He was able to call 911. Shaw was flown from the scene to University Hospital in Columbia, Missouri, for treatment. A hospital spokesman said that Shaw was listed in fair condition. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you take a .357 Magnum out with you when you're fishing alone at a family member's farm and take it out to play with while you're waiting for the fish to bite? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0623. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0623. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CFMU in Hamilton. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were listening to this at the same time as watching The Wizard of Oz and listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, well, it's a waste of electricity. There are some things you just can't multitask.